Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today is Molly Nesbitt, art historian and professor of art here at Vassar College. She's also a contributing editor to the magazine Art Forum, and she's here to talk with us about her book, The Pragmatism in the History of Art, published last year by Periscope Publishing. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you, Tom.
It's great to have you on the show. To start off generally, can you tell us what The Pragmatism in the History of Art is about?
It might be better rather to tell you a little bit about how the book came into being, because it was a response to a set of questions I was asking myself. And those questions were germinated, let's say, by the work I did with contemporary art and contemporary artists, which started with, you know, the writing I did for Art Forum, which builds a conversation and which expanded. But it took a turn around the year 2000 when Hans-Ulrich Obrist, the Swiss curator, asked me if I wanted to do a book with him. And the book was a kind of experimental book about nominally utopia. But it was meant to be collectively written and pulled together with artist projects and a series of intellectual contributions, but from writers and architects and filmmakers and so on. And the question I began to ask myself was, what is the difference between a writer, an art critic, and an art historian? Because by and large, art historians were not taking their tools to the consideration of contemporary art in a direct way. But because I had done some experimental writing about Duchamp, to be brief about it, my historical work came to the attention of people like Hans-Ulrich Obrist and Ogwey and Wesor. And so I was being drawn into their conversation, which had a lot to do with an expansion of the discussion around art, both in international terms and in, let's say, subject matter terms. And the Utopia book ends up growing into an exhibition project that we did with Rikri Tiruvanija called Utopia Station that had its first appearance actually at Vassar. We did a seminar weekend.
This was in the early 2000s, as I remember?
It was in the spring of 2003, and it was the weekend, by coincidence, the weekend of the international peace marches, hoping to dissuade George Bush and his government from invading Iraq. Anyhow, but that project, which is very complex, and we could do a whole show on it sometime if you wanted to, it gave me a different ground in which to operate. And the big question coming out of Utopia Station was, how will we document ourselves? How will we write our story? And who's going to do it? And I realized that I didn't want to be the one to package or write a premature history of Utopia Station, that the way in which one would talk about, you know, what we were doing and what the individual contributions were and how they were engaged with events as they were moving forward or events that were stalled or things in the world was fairly complicated. And it required a different kind of writing approach. And that left me brooding. Now, meanwhile, my curator friends were busy talking to me about the kinds of thinking that had inspired them, and in particular the work of Alexander Dorner, who was a curator in Hanover in the 20s and the 30s until the Nazis chased him out, and then he came to the United States in the late 30s. And eventually, out of his experiences with curating, in which he tried to see history very large and let the museum embrace all of time and space, but not collapse it into just one thing. Eventually, he wrote a book called The Way Beyond Art. Art was in quotation marks, because he saw art to be expansive as an activity, not something that was separated from everyday life. And the way in which we were thinking about collaborating in Utopia Station was to see no activity being completely separate from any other. So that all the aesthetics of separation were being rendered moot. and whether they were generated by formalism or they were generated, you know, through Kantian philosophy, whatever, or just pure elitism, they were rendered moot.
And this would be definitions of art. A definition of art is one of the things that...
is one of the things that has belabored and beleaguered the discussion on art in the 20th century. Yeah. You know, the question, what is art? It's not a productive question.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a defensive question, usually. You know, is photography art? Mm. Was another way of asking that same question. And it tends to make art into a category. Mm-hmm. And art, I think, is actually not. It doesn't exist as a category. Yeah. You could say it's a practice.
Yes,
it's a way of engaging with existence. It's a way of thinking about the very large questions that face us all, like where do we put the line between life and death, for example. And that expansive way of thinking about how art exists and how it can be and how we want to think about its future was something that began to haunt me in the years when Utopia Station was coming into being and afterwards, because I was then returning to, you know, my other kind of writing, and I was trying to think about how to pull what I had learned into practice as an art historian.
Yeah.
And it was at that point that I began to work on Foucault pretty directly and to look at the way in which he had put his thinking into the world. And it's one small step to thinking about how an art historian would put their thinking into the world. And it's kind of a long-winded answer, but it's not a quick flip to the channel called pragmatism, because pragmatism is not just a channel or an option. It's a way of working that is just as expansive and as complex as that way of working that Utopia Station had opened up, which I began to understand came not just from Alexander Dorner, but from this way of working that the Americans in the late 19th century, William James and Charles Sanders Peirce and Oliver Wendell Holmes too, and then John Dewey, began to formulate as a philosophical position that one could take to life. And as it happens, that pragmatist way of working finds its effects as well in the way in which art history began to settle in and take root in this country in the 20s and the 30s.
Yeah, interesting. Especially with Dewey, he was very interested in art and the relation between art and experience.
Yeah, and also in seeing it to have social value in the best way, and that its social value would take effect in the definition of new museums with larger public outreach. So, you know, he refined his thinking in collaboration with Dr. Albert Barnes, who was putting together the Barnes Foundation and his collection in Marion. But the other effects of this way of thinking of Dewey's vis-a-vis education are to be found as well in Catherine Dreyer's collaborations with the New School in the 30s.
Yeah, he was a supporter of the New School when it was founded, wasn't he?
Dewey, yeah, he helped found it.
Yeah, he did,
And remained very much involved. The other place, you know, that sets bells ringing in the minds of people who know about and care about modern art is Black Mountain College, where Dewey didn't have personally that much of an effect, but people who'd been inspired by his learning by doing and his educational policies and the broad outreach to a broad, well, to everybody.
Yeah.
And everybody has the right to an education, Dewey would have said. But education must be useful.
His work underpinned the WPA projects to some extent, didn't they, the arts projects?
Yeah, with Holger Cahill so on. He was a what we would now call a public intellectual of the highest quality and had a very deep effect. Cornel West tips his hat to John Dewey, too.
It's interesting that you should find Dewey and William James and Peirce as linchpins, in a sense, in that they're not often spoken of as having anything to offer us in the way of solutions to contemporary problems. I mean, they haven't been since the Second World War. Post-structuralists generally haven't looked to them for inspiration. Derrida characterized Dewey as a naive liberal. So your going back to these American thinkers is a bit unusual, isn't it? I mean, it's a movement on your part.
Yes, and also I'm claiming it that way of working for historians, because the pragmatists cared a great deal about analyzing particular phenomena in their material existence in time and space.
Yeah.
And they were also very interested, James says this right away, in studying the effects of phenomena on the fields of activity around them and in the future.
So the question is, were the pragmatists pragmatic by their own rules? Did they have an effect?
Well, right. But also the other question is, can these ways of working or this kind of analysis or this close focus and the interest in studying effects, not just change, but effects, and weighing these effects, that actually is part and parcel of an historian's work, but historians work on the present as it exists in the past. Mm-hmm. And so that question of, you know, the present haunts historians just as much as it haunts the art critic or the person living in the now. Yeah. And presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S, are something that we don't try to analyze as having particular qualities necessarily. Mm-hmm. We don't look at one present versus another present so much as historians. We get very focused.
Yeah.
And as art historians, we have tended to see art as a separate phenomena or as a manifestation of an idea so that it can become ideological. But what I realized as I began to study in detail the ways of working of particular art historians, whom I admire, mm-hmm. it has to be said. Yeah. I wasn't, you know, just going higgledy-piggledy. But people like Meyer Shapiro mm-hmm. or Alexander Dorner mm-hmm. or the Frenchman Henri Faucillon, who will come to America and play a large role in setting up the art history department at Yale in the 30s, all of these people had a way of working that took the historical material extremely seriously mm-hmm. and thought hard about how to put it into motion mm-hmm. for a modern person's consciousness and for modern culture generally, so that modernity wouldn't involve a complete rupture with everything we already knew. One could weigh modernity and see the continuities. They were very sophisticated and enterprising as they went forward, and they didn't go forward with some kind of system that they were trying to build. It was a true experiment.
Pragmatism.
Yeah. But to answer your question about what happened mm-hmm. after the Second World War, well, Faucillon died. Dorner didn't have a museum to run by the early years of the Second World War, and he would never get another one mm-hmm. to run.
And while he ran in this country, was it RISD?
It was the Rhode Island School of Designs Museum.
Yeah.
And
still see his influence there when you look at the way they do exhibits, really wonderfully put together and not what you're used to when you walk into an art museum.
I mean, the period room.
So.
Well, he left a mark, but he really left a mark with that book, The Way Beyond Art, which became a kind of Bible, especially in Europe, for people who, trying to think about how to take curating to the next level. But in this country, Faucillon died during the war. Shapiro lost a base of operations in some big way because of the targeting of communists in this country after the war. So he shifted gears and became more interested in the ways to harness psychoanalysis. He became very interested in his particular conversations with mm-hmm. artists whom he welcomed into his classes at Columbia University. And then he also began to work more concretely, although not all that actively in terms of writing, but he began to work more concretely with the work of the logical positivists who'd come from Vienna mm-hmm. to America, people like Carnap. And he had a good philosopher friend named Ernst Nagel mm-hmm. at Columbia with whom he talked these things through. Anyway, the net result is that, you know, this pragmatism loses its momentum. Dewey is still alive, but Dewey's not a young man anymore. But the real problem for intellectuals in the United States after the war is the targeting of communists and Marxists. And so, although Dewey was not a communist, this way of thinking was bound up with social reform and socialism in the minds of many people.
Yeah. Well, WPA, for one. Yeah.
Yes. So there was an attack, right? A kind of culture war that was ideologically based. So that was one reason for the recession mm-hmm. of this way of thinking. And the other has to do with the fact that I think in the minds of many people, the model seemed to be, or the way of working seemed to be exhausted, and that the new logics coming from Europe, from Vienna, for example, were more attractive, that using psychoanalysis to analyze culture put forward new possibilities. And the Marxists regrouped, and when they came back, they developed a much more idea-driven and mm-hmm. ideological agenda intellectually yeah. in the 60s. And so Dewey looked soft in comparison to Althusser.
There's, of course, a huge change in the kind of art that's being made also in the 1940s, 1950s, you know, with abstract expressionism.
Yeah, modern art was being identified with the work of individual artists yeah. more than avant-garde's.
And it was commodified to some extent, right?
Issue actually is the push to justify modern art by virtue of its superiority yeah. and its separate existence yeah. from the stuff of everyday life. Yeah. There was a high culture yeah. to which modern art belonged, and there was a formalist way of analyzing and supporting this, which meant that the work of art should be cut from the world.
Yeah.
There should be that break to abstraction. And that break meant a kind of detachment from the present and from the material things of life and the ordinary person's
response. Yeah, and that's supported by Alfred Barr at MoMA and critics like Greenberg and
very much. And it was very powerful. Yeah. And it produced a modernist way of thinking yeah. that accompanied modern art and is yeah. still very strong.
Yeah.
So the way in which the pragmatist tools come back into view is strangely, you know, in the arts anyway, through the work of people like Michel Foucault and mm-hmm. Gilles Deleuze.
Yeah.
Because they looked at pragmatism and they found things for their own ways of thinking in the late 60s.
Yeah. So your book essentially is a history, isn't it? I mean, if I were to characterize it, I would say it's a history of writing about art in the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, it looks at the way ideas are actually transmitted
mm-hmm.
from books to people mm-hmm. and by people to other people. And that history of transmission involves the idea being absorbed and returning in another form
yeah.
often. And that whole business of transmission is fundamental to the business of education. And so the other part of my life, of course, involves teaching and thinking about how to bring the past into the present and into the minds of people who are 18 years old and don't have a lot of points of reference.
Yeah.
And so you have to build anew, you know, build the ideas anew, introduce the work of Picasso anew,
yeah.
and give it a way of existing in present-day culture so that it
yeah.
can connect,
yeah.
you know, not to dumb it down, but just connect and go live again. And that whole business of transmission is not so different from the way in which the epics of old were transmitted from generation to generation to generation. There is an order of knowledge which deserves to have a life beyond us. And it falls to those of us who know something about those orders of knowledge and can carry them forward to do so. But, you know, you give them and then it's up to those who receive this thing. You think it's a gift. They may not.
Yeah.
But it's up to them to do
what they will,
the next, yeah.
yeah. So as a history, you're pulling back a bit from the single narrative line and looking for another way to give life to presences that generate change. I mean, history tends to be deterministic, yes. And it seems to me you're trying to work away from that, both the way you formulate language and also in the way you structure the book.
Well, it's this whole business of transmission is not an abstract matter. And it's very much tied to the emphases that particular people put mm-hmm. on particular ideas
yeah.
and particular works.
Yeah.
And when Meyer Shapiro wants to write about Van Gogh in 1946, in full knowledge of what had just happened during World War II, which was horrific, you know, he chooses a picture to talk about that opens the space of the world so wide that it takes more than one person to see this little picture of crows in a wheat field, he says. And that picture stands for the role that a work of art can play.
Mm-hmm.
Van Gogh didn't paint his crows in a wheat field in the late 1880s, knowing that somebody, after the atom bomb had been dropped and the Holocaust in Europe had been revealed, was going to use it as a way to make sense
mm-hmm.
of a new present.
Yeah.
But the work functions in that way. And it brings the old wheat field and the ground of the wheat field forward so that a scene of nature and rural life can somehow provide the ground on which to stand for mm-hmm. this modernity that's blowing itself up, sort of wrapped around death. And Shapiro's very eloquent on all of this. But history is as much contained in those experiences and their personal experiences.
Yeah.
As it is contained in the abstract forces that push us all forward.
Yeah. And that's a tenet of at least Dewey's pragmatism, as I remember, isn't it, that there's an emphasis on the particular as opposed to the abstract.
Yes.
And I noticed you titled your book The Pragmatism in the History of Art, not just plain old pragmatism in the history of art.
Well, the other reason I wanted to write the book, actually, was partly to work through this material for myself,
mm-hmm.
because it's not something, the details here of, you know, Shapiro's way of building his thinking, or Phocion's way of shifting gears as he came to America, were not known. But the archives of Phocion and George Kubler mm-hmm. and Meyer Shapiro have become available. And so one can really plunge into them and see how an art historian worked in some detail. Depends on the archive,
yeah.
of course. And right now, art history is, by most people's account, at something of a crossroads. The big questions driving the field are not obvious.
Mm-hmm.
The directions that the general discussions are going to take are not obvious. The role that research plays, the kind of research that weighs and tests its concepts against the evidence that it builds, the kind of research that is conscious, right, of how it's being designed. It's
mm-hmm.
not just going out and looking for facts here and there and roping them in. It sort of thinks about the ensemble of facts, you know, as a having a material existence and as expressing another kind of reality besides
mm-hmm.
themselves. That kind of research, which takes time to do and takes support to carry on, is not being done so much right now because it's hard to find the support. But for art history, it seemed to me that the way in which the other fields develop their research designs, the way in which art history works with those research designs from other fields,
mm-hmm.
as well as the questions from other fields, was something that I learned how to do when I went to graduate school,
mm-hmm.
which happened in the years after 1968, which was a hugely experimental time in art history.
Yeah.
We now realize. I thought it was normal, but
yeah.
it was hugely experimental time. And it was a pretty inspiring time
mm-hmm.
To walk into the field because the discussions were fraught,
yeah.
passionate discussions. But the people I now teach don't have access to those discussions. They don't have a sense of what those research alternatives are like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote this book in part for them, just to show them not just where I come from, but
mm-hmm.
where they could come from,
yeah.
too. And in a way, this book is not very long, but it is itself meant to be a kind of toolbox.
You know, talking about the dynamism of the 1960s and early 70s, there is an awful lot going on in this period for a modernist art historian to keep track of, with important contributions by art historians, curators, and artists, all altering the cultural and historical landscape. You cite, for instance, Kynaston McShine's exhibit Information, which constitutes a kind of revolutionary change of focus for the Museum of Modern Art. You've got artists like Lawrence Wiener pushing the envelope with conceptualist works like Residue of a Flare, Ignited Upon a Boundary, that you talk about in the book. You know, you've got Smithson in Utah creating a spiral jetty. You've got the pop art movement in Warhol. You have scholars like Robert Herbert and T.J. Clark looking at all kinds of evidence to connect histories of art to social and material histories, and to spread the field of modernism again back into the 19th century. And everybody seems to be breaking molds and reaching out in extraordinary ways to push art into places that would have been difficult to imagine only a few years earlier. And, of course, that's what the times were like for those of us who lived through them. You know, you just had to walk down the street and look into the faces of people looking back at you to know there was something going on, some kind of a surge of change, whether it was culture, art, or nature. And if you did feel this, you know, you felt instinctively, I think it was a good thing. I did, anyway. And I wonder about what it was all about to this day. You know, how do you explain it? So that's my question. How do you explain it? And I'd give you a break and add, at least in terms of the art world, but that's just the thing. The art world and the world weren't two different spaces all of a sudden.
Part of what was happening, and I think we should be very clear that the story my book tells
mm-hmm.
is an American story.
Yeah.
And you know, it looks at the way in which this transmission mm-hmm. involves European culture, involves European interlocutors. It's certainly not nativist mm-hmm. in nature. But the transmission itself is, I study it as it happens in America. Mm-hmm. And when it ricochets off to Foucault and Deleuze, it will come back to America.
Yeah.
It's part of an exchange between the old world and the new world.
Interestingly, the form that pragmatism takes for the French isn't Dewey so much, is it? And our theoreticians as our novelists, it seemed, with Deleuze and even with Sartre. Sartre was really completely taken with Faulkner, Deleuze with Melville.
Well, they didn't see philosophy and literature to be absolutely separate activities, which is the next thing to say.
Yeah.
That you can write an American art history, mm-hmm. you can write about a way of working that takes shape and in many ways takes root in America, art historically speaking, flies in the face of the way art history's lineage is usually mm-hmm. charted, which is it's usually a German story. But what was happening in the 60s can't be quickly summarized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very complex. The conditions on the ground in every country are different. There mm-hmm. are often regional differences. But the pressures on the peacetime cultures mm-hmm. that had evolved after the war in the industrial nations, those pressures became too much to bear. And peace was beautiful, but peace couldn't be so simple mm-hmm. or so uniformly defined. And so as the different pressures and the different pieces of the population and the heterogeneous nature of culture began to reassert itself,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to reassert itself in the context of needing civil rights, mm-hmm. it's going to assert itself in the context of women needing more rights or equal rights. You know, these questions are really deep and troubling
mm-hmm.
and difficult questions, you know, for any culture. But anyway, in our culture, the definition of peace, you know, a culture at peace, needed to be reset. And once the Vietnam War entered the picture,
mm-hmm.
it became clear that the way the 50s had come together in the United States wouldn't suffice to keep war away, that, you know, all of a sudden it was a wartime society, not a peacetime society. And the givens that had set all of needed to be reset. And in the context of that, the idea of the work of art as separate and higher from everything else seemed elitist.
Yeah.
And it seemed to disempower the work of art.
Yeah.
And so to get the power back, artists and others sought to reintegrate it into other practices, be they musical practices or architectural practices or design practices or, you know, performance practices. And so the effort to pull art back into life
mm-hmm.
was pretty general. You know, probably most importantly, as far as the general culture was concerned, took place in music. And
it was a driving force, certainly.
And by the time these forces play out and these givens are challenged and blown up and reset in some kind of provisional way, but reset.
Yeah, whether it's Jimi Hendrix or John Cage.
Right.
By
the time the givens are challenged and provisionally reset, because they haven't really been reset yet, the old distinctions between a high culture and a low culture
mm-hmm.
have eroded. And so the idea of high culture and avant-garde culture being one and the same seems misplaced. It remains a kind of fiction that is perpetuated for another 20 years.
Yeah.
But in reality, it's clear that popular culture, the culture of the people, is now setting the pace. And it's up to artists to figure out how to join.
So generally speaking, you know, you focus on certain art historians, critics, and artists, you know, John Dewey, Alexander Dorner, Michel Foucault, Meyer Shapiro, George Kubler, Lawrence Wiener, Gordon Matta Clark, and Linda Nochlin, and a few more. But it's a select list in your pantheon of pragmatists, and though probably that's not the way to put it because you're not setting up a canon here of any kind. But anyway, there are names you might have added that don't appear, especially Duchamp, of course, jumps to mind, but maybe he's such a presence here that he doesn't have to be named. But, you know, Fluxus comes to mind, the whole pop art movement, possibly. So I wonder, can you talk about whether there are any lacunae that you might have included that you didn't in the group that might have altered the story in some way or filled it out or illuminated it?
I could have written a much bigger book.
That's only 100, how many pages is it here?
Not so many. There are two things to say about this. One is that I wasn't trying to write a global history of the way the pragmatist idea actually takes shape. It's up to somebody else to write about the way in which these ideas move into the art schools, the way they touch John Cage, they touch Alan Kaprow, they have a big effect on the way the art at the New School is understood and taught and transmitted. There's an underground culture to this pragmatism in which the ideas are absorbed. I mean, maybe I wasn't being asked to read John Dewey's Artist Experience in graduate school, but my artist friends might well have been.
Yeah, we were reading it when I was an undergraduate in the 60s still. So partly because I was at a teacher's college and it was still very important in education, Dewey still looms large in that field.
Yeah, but because he had allied himself with Albert Barnes and not with the Museum of Modern Art, he was considered to belong to the wrong camp, I think, by the modernists. And also his, if you read Artist Experience, you know, painting doesn't figure heavily into it. He sees art very broadly to include all the arts. So this is not the end of a story, right? It's just part of the story. And it's part of the story that's very specifically about the way art history itself is implicated. And the other reason that it operates in the way it does is because my teacher, Robert Herbert, said to me memorably once, work by sample. When you work by sample, that allows you to develop very specific, pointed, detailed subjects for your story. And so the way the story can be told, and history involves, you know, analysis, but also it's got a narrative to it. So, you know, I saw my purpose here was to work by sample to show pretty carefully and as vividly as I could what it meant to put an idea about art into the world, and what the stakes were, you know, what the conditions were, what the world was like, what the effects could be, the way an art historian's thinking would be changed. And that the thinking wasn't something static, but something dynamic.
Yeah, history isn't static.
But no, well, the writing of history isn't either. And the writing of history, I think, has a lot going for it in this day and age because it's so capacious.
Is Kubler an influence here as well as Herbert? I'm thinking of A Shape of Time.
Kubler's Shape of Time, it affected me, but I didn't understand how to work with it until much later. No, but the book itself, when it came out in the early 60s, because Kubler was teaching at Yale, and the Yale Art School at that point was a powerhouse of talent, that book found itself in the hands of artists very quickly, and it was extremely useful to them as a way of expanding their idea of what they were doing. You know, comparing art to stars, meaning the stars in the sky now, you know, that's a whole different kind of space of operations than, you know, the New York gallery world. So it went to New York, right, in those conversations. It went lots of places in those conversations. And it became a book that was a touchstone for Robert Smithson. And I think that's how later artists have come to find it, you know, because it was a big book for Smithson. So they go look at Smithson's big books and, you know, whether it's Borges or whether it's Kubler, or whether it's Norbert Wiener, there it is. And they use those books like batteries, you know, to charge up. So Kubler's book's very influential. It touches many art historians who read it, but it's not a book from which you can make recipes of your own. It's more like a power source of some strange, mysterious kind.
Yeah, well, interesting you should put it like that because he did have a background in electrodynamics, Kubler did, didn't he?
Well, Kubler, when he wrote his book, it's unlike anything else he ever wrote. And he wrote his book when he was gravely ill. And he was in a sanatorium and he thought he was going to die. And early on in the book, he conjures up the deathbed scene of his teacher, Henri Faucillon. And as Faucillon is dying in New Haven in 1943, the question he's haunted by is the question of actuality. What is actuality, Faucillon asks over and over again. And it was a question, I now know, that was on his mind for 20 years before he had his head on the pillow of his deathbed. But it's a question that he gave to Kubler, just as he gave his unfinished book on time to Kubler. Not formally, I don't think, but Kubler took Faucillon's legacy and he began to work with those questions himself. But the place where he wrote them down was in the book that he was writing when he thought he himself had his head on the pillow of his deathbed. Yeah. So, you know, that gives you a different kind of perspective on what it is you're doing with yourself and your work and your writing. Yeah. And it also means you can let your questions go out into the ether and let them dissolve. And when you do that, they're not the kind of questions that somebody else who's not willing to let everything go out into the heavens yet can work with very readily. Yeah. You know, they're not concrete enough. Yeah. They're not focused down enough. But many, many people, many art historians have been inspired by Kubler's book. And I use it, actually, to begin my course on art from 1968 to now. And by saying, listen, this is a book that meant a lot to artists. I want you to think about reading it like an artist would and see what happens. And that sort of charge to think about reading like an artist destabilizes the classroom assignment.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
You know, and it then lets that book and the ideas in the book kind of seep into the material of the course in a different kind of way.
Yeah, interesting. We do have a joint program, too, between studio and art history, and you have students that are taking both studio courses and art history courses, so it'd be an interesting mix.
Well, I also have philosophers and students of literature. Yeah. The mix of ideas already in their minds is pretty big.
Yeah. As it should be for an undergraduate.
It must be.
You end the book with Gordon Mata Clark and his tree dance, which seems to me, as a matter of your trajectory in the book, absolutely perfect. Perhaps because the material involved here is in part the atmosphere, the sky, which was very important to Mata Clark. So can you talk to us about Poughkeepsie and tree dance and why it ends here in Poughkeepsie?
Well, it ends where it does for a couple of different reasons. The moves being made out of Shapiro's work were begun by three different art historians, Robert Herbert, T.J. Clark, and Linda Nochlin. And Linda Nochlin taught at Vassar. And at Vassar, she invented feminist art history. And she didn't invent that part of her work from Shapiro's essays. Mm-hmm. But her work had started in her dissertation on the work of Courbet. And Shapiro had written a landmark article in 1941 on Courbet and popular imagery. So Linda Nochlin's work expands on that, just as Bob Herbert's did and T.J. Clark's did. They all expand in different ways, as I explain. But Linda's moves to the question of realism, and realism as a political position in 1848, as an expression of actuality, let's say. And then simultaneously, she herself in the late 60s began to realize that she needed to be involved with the women's movement in a real way and in an intellectual way. And so she wrote an essay at Vassar called Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists?, in which she asks the question and then she answers it. And the answer has everything to do with the way women had been denied an education to the arts and to the symbolically most powerful forms in the arts. So without the ability to study the nude, and this all has to do with the classical tradition and the way you mobilize it. And women were not, you know, for reasons of prudery and propriety, not allowed to study the nude in great detail and at great length. They were denied the ability to really mobilize the classical forms and thereby denied the ability to express themselves in the terms of history of the day. And that meant that they didn't have access to that kind of greatness and that kind of authority in the culture. So she explains all of this. Mm-hmm. It all boils down to needing an education, the need to, as well, accept that one had been disadvantaged and disempowered in the past, but that didn't necessarily mean that the present or the future would continue to oppress. Anyway, she wrote that essay here in the spring of 1971, which happens to be the same time that Mary Delahoyd organized a show called 26 by 26, a group show that was experimental, in many ways inspired by the information show and the work of Lucy Lippard, another landmark curator. And it created a set of conditions here that spring that opened things up, not just art historically, but culturally.
Yeah, there was a lot going on that spring.
Well, it was still the 60s, as we would say now. And Hannah Arendt gave a speech in the chapel about thinking and moral considerations. Anyway, it was a mix.
Yeah.
And it was that mix of experiences that I found when I came to Vassar for my freshman year. Mm-hmm. And so in a strange way, the book ends where I get woken up and need to make something of all of that as I went forward.
Yeah, I thought the book, without being overt about it, it has a confessional feeling.
It's personal.
It's personal,
the book
yeah.
Is it personal.
It's personal, yeah,
yeah
sure.
Yeah.
So I'd like to thank you, Molly, for joining us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, The Pragmatism and the History of Art, published last year by Periscope Publishing.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to come to a cafe in the library.
Yeah. Wish we did. Nick made that same joke. Where the hell's the coffee at the end of the recording? So, okay. Well, thanks, Molly.
Hey, thank you.